thank you so much for turning up out of term time and to see such a good audience for this event. We are incredibly pleased to have AGEM Poo here. It's a real treat. We've been trying to get her for over a year. I'm not going to read out all the awards she's won as one of the most influential people in the world, which is great when you think it's about organising domestic and care workers. How wonderful is that? If that's influence, I want it, which is very different from the normal influence. So it's an absolute delight. So thank you very, very much for turning up. We're really, really pleased. And the event has been supported and funded wonderfully by the Atlantic Fellows Organisation, Atlantic Philanthropies, who, again, is quite unusual for a large funding organisation to actually support domestic worker unions. Kind of unheard of in Britain. So, again, we're very, very pleased to Chris Exley and to Atlantic for enabling this to happen. It is very unusual, let me say, to have domestic worker unions in this presence, not having to protest, rather to actually speak. So that's really, really good. We're going to begin by showing a short film. Then AGEM Poo has a little exercise for you. And then we'll probably do about 20 minutes of discussion, just so we raise some topics that hopefully are very relevant to you and make sense and inspire you to ask questions. And then we'll go into questions until 7:45. So we should have plenty of time. So we would like it to be very open, and we would like you to ask lots of questions. This is a great opportunity, one I've been really, really looking forward to. So should we start with your film?
Can we start with the exercise?
Okay, you want to start with the exercise?
First of all, thank you all so much for coming out tonight. It's wonderful to see so many people at this time in the evening, and to see so many people caring about care. And it's also really fun for me to be here because I've secretly always wanted to be an economist. Maybe in another life, but I get to pretend to be one tonight with all of you, so that's really fun. And especially to be with such a wonderful feminist economist like Bev tonight. It's really an honor and a joy. Thank you so much. Okay, so we're going to start by actually bringing your experiences and your stories into this conversation. And I'm going to ask you to do something that I ask almost every room that I'm in, which is to turn to the person sitting next to you and share a story about someone in your life who has cared for you and the value of that relationship. So just share 1 minute, take 1 minute to kind of share and then switch so the other person can share, and I'll let you know when you have about 20 seconds left. 2 minutes.
Okay, can we do, stick your hands up and stop talking.
Great, thank you so much for sharing your stories. Can we just go ahead and give all the people who cared for us in our lives a big round of applause of recognition. And I like to start with that because it just is such a powerful reminder of how universal the experience of care, the need for care, care really does connect us all. And it's something that we rarely make visible, we so undervalue, and we rarely discuss, whether as a policy issue or anything else, but it is so fundamental to everything that we do, and it is actually quite powerful and transformative the way that it connects us. And so we really use the power of our care stories a lot in the movement that I'm a part of because of what a powerful reminder that is. And what I'm about to show you is a short video called We All Care, that we created to start telling the story of how care connects us all, and particularly in the United States as the aging population grows and people live longer than ever, right? People are aging. The baby boom generation is aging at a rate of 10,000 people turning 70 per day. Every 8 seconds, someone turns 70 in the United States. And because of advances in healthcare and medicine, people are living longer than ever before, an average of 20 years longer than when we first put our safety net into place. And so we're about to have this huge older population, and we've not really planned for it or talked about it. And yet it is affecting our lives and changing. It will change everything. It's something that it does connect us. And this video was about talking about that in a way that is intergenerational and shows some different dimensions to that. And it'll also give you a sense of how we use storytelling in our work. Could you show the video?
You are a wonderful, joyful, loving person.
You're like a father figure to me.
You are. Just gentle.
We care about each other. And we take an interest in each other.
Before I came to this country, I was taking care of my grandmother. So I felt that I can do the job.
I took it for granted that, you know, if I wanted to do anything, I would get up, go out, shopping, visiting people. Unfortunately, that's no longer the case.
I noticed you were changing years ago.
After I being able to get you to go outside, I got the opportunity then to go places with you.
When I got home from rehab after being away for over 3 months, the first thing I saw were 8 balloons that you had put up around my door, welcoming me back. And I knew I was truly home.
I am totally honored to be a caregiver for you. It is a great privilege and a joy for me.
There are so many things that I still can't do that I depend on you to help me. And the help is given so freely and with so much love, and that makes me feel a lot better. And still independent, but as I said, independent with benefits.
We are not only just caregivers, you're a nutritionist, you're a nurse, you're the doctor.
You are my mother, Julie Davis, and you are loved by a whole lot of people.
You're Dr. Morris Steiner. You are my patient. You're a pediatrician, war veteran. You have taught me things that I know would take me through the rest of my life.
You are my community, but you're even more than that. You are my friends. And as much as you've done for me, there's nothing that I wouldn't do for you also.
So we're going to begin with a bit of background, because Adrian Pugh is a key organiser as well as being the recipient of many awards. And you managed, I think this is astounding, you co-founded the National Domestic Workers Organization of America with 50 other people, and you've managed to get 200,000 members, mm-hmm. which is quite an achievement in itself. And in 2011, you set up Caring Across Generations. Can you tell us a bit more about how you did that? Because mm-hmm. that's a huge scale.
Yeah. Well, how many of you know somebody who works as a domestic worker or a care worker? Okay. So a lot of you, so you're familiar with this workforce. In 1998, I started out organizing domestic workers in New York City because they were the workers who consistently would come to meetings when we would say, we're offering health fairs or know your rights clinics or any kind of resources or services for low-wage workers in the community. Domestic workers were always the ones to most consistently come, and it was what we realized, that the isolation of the work really meant that people understood the value of the collective and coming together and organizing in a really unique way. As we came to understand the work better and better, what we started to understand was that there are just a whole bunch of deep structural issues that and cultural factors that have shaped the conditions of work for this workforce in the United States and probably globally as well. In the U.S., there is some of the first domestic workers were enslaved African women, and the legacy of slavery has actually profoundly shaped this industry from the beginning. In the 1930s, when our labor laws were being put into place, the southern members of Congress, who were very much dependent on a plantation economy, refused to support the labor laws that were being proposed as part of the New Deal if they included farm workers and domestic workers. And so in a concession to those members of Congress, our nation's most fundamental labor protections, the right to minimum wage, the right to collectively bargain and form a union, basic core pillars of our labor laws explicitly excluded domestic workers and farm workers. And that exclusion has really shaped the nature and conditions of this workforce, on top of the fact that the work itself is associated with women, right? The caregiving and cleaning work that happens in the home has generally been associated with work that women should do and have been taken for granted, right? Has been taken for granted that women will do. And so between the kind of deep cultural norms and the way that we have so culturally devalued the work that women do and the very explicit exclusions in the labor laws and the protections of this workforce rooted in that legacy of racial exclusion in the United States, we essentially had a situation where it was like the Wild West in this workforce. You just never knew what you were going to get. You might find a wonderful family who you work with for years, and it's a very healthy, respectful relationship. And then you might find the whole other end of the spectrum. And we saw cases of human trafficking and rape and sexual violence and everything in between. There were no standards, no guidelines. It was very much at the whim of each individual household. And so as we started bringing workers together, we started asking the question of why are there no standards and how do we put them in place? And so we started organizing initially city by city, actually community by community. Then we came together across communities. And then in New York City, we established an organizing campaign to try to change the laws in the city. And we realized you had to go to the state to change the labor laws. So in 2010, we had our very first breakthrough, where we were able to pass the first domestic worker bill of rights in the state of New York. And it was the first bill to not only eliminate the exclusions in the existing labor protection, so to establish a set of rights and protections for the workforce, but it also did more. It offered paid days off for domestic workers. So domestic workers became the first workers in the state of New York to have paid days off mandated by law. That's now expanded, but that was because of a 7-year organizing campaign that achieved that, and that inspired workers around the country to organize. And honestly, for most of the last 20 years, that work has been very slow and incrementally building, right? Meeting by meeting, community by community, city by city. And that support and connection across cities, that sisterhood that was formed through the formation of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, we would give each other strength and energy and inspiration and share our victories. Today, we have 64 affiliate organizations and chapters all over the country. 9 states have passed domestic worker bills of rights. New Mexico just became the most recent state about 6 weeks ago. And we are preparing to introduce a national bill of rights for domestic workers to cover all 50 states, 2.5 million workers. And so we're making progress in establishing rights. But what we realized about 2010, was a lot of our members were coming to us and saying, you know, the family that I work for is asking me to take care of Aunt Joan who has Alzheimer's, or the grandmother who just came home from the hospital after having a stroke, and I don't feel prepared to do that work. But I want to help, I want to support, so can you provide training? Can you provide support? Can you help me figure out how to do this job? And it was such a trend that we decided to take a step back and understand what was going on, and we realized this massive demographic shift underway. This huge and growing need on the part of American families for elder care support and support for people with disabilities. And the fact that we were wholly unprepared, that families were struggling as we started to ask families about their experience of needing care. They were struggling to afford it, to find it, to manage it. And then the workforce, the workers that we were talking to who do home care can barely sustain in their jobs because they're earning poverty wages with unpredictable hours or not enough hours. The annual median income for a home care worker in the United States is $15,000 per year, which is impossible to pay the bills, let alone raise a family. So the workforce that we're counting on in the U.S. to take care of us can't take care of their own families doing this as a profession. So we looked at it and we just saw in every dimension of the experience of care in America, completely broken, completely and profoundly not working. And that is why we decided to launch Caring Across Generations, to build a movement of families and workers together in the United States to catalyze a transformation in our care systems, our care infrastructure, to make care affordable and accessible to every family who needs it, and to make every last care job a good job for the 21st century that you can really take pride in and support your family on, and one generation can do better than the next.
And it's really interesting that you're talking about not being able to care for your own family because you're caring for somebody else's. Because I think what we've learned through, say, the research that we've done at the III and that some of our Atlantic fellows have done and are doing, that this is a global problem. So, you know, we know that the Philippines, for instance, includes the export of women, which usually care workers, mm-hmm. to places like the US and to the UK, in their GDP. Mm. So we know that what you're experiencing in the US itself is actually a massive global problem that transfers labour from the global south often to the global north. Not always, because the Middle East is a key recipient of care workers, so it's not straightforward. But we do know from one of our previous fellows, Saeed or Ali, that a lot of the care work as well follows colonial routes, mm-hmm. so out of Africa into its colonial, past. Mm-hmm. So the future is actually a really big global problem, mm-hmm. because I know when, and it's really funny, I can't hold up a Kindle. Normally I'd hold up a book and go, you've got to read this book. But if you hold up a Kindle, it's going to be really embarrassing. But in your book, you show how this problem is the sense that a lot of one of the big issues is undocumented workers, illegal workers, those who have no protection, mm-hmm. In terms of getting a minimum wage, those who have no recourse to the law. So I wonder how you think of it on, because you've built so much, is it possible to transfer that organization onto a bigger global platform, do you think?
Yeah, well, we actually are part of a global federation of domestic workers called the International Domestic Workers, mm-hmm. Federation. And we formed in the wake of an opportunity to establish the very first International Labor Organization Convention on Domestic Work, which we were successful in doing in 2011. And we just celebrated June 16th is actually International Domestic Workers Day because it commemorates the 2011 date that we were able to pass the ILO Convention 189.
June the 16th.
Yeah. Decent Work for Domestic Workers, Convention 189 at the ILO, established global standards for domestic work for the very first time. There are about 70 million domestic workers around the world. And since 2011, I believe the number is 27 countries have ratified the convention. So obviously we have many more to go. There's a very active campaign in Kenya to pass, to ratify. Mexico has agreed to ratify. So there's a whole global call to action to ratify the convention, and that conversation is very much connected to a conversation about the future of the care economy. Right now, this workforce is so precarious and unsustainable. Right now, in most countries, the care economy is starved. It's completely under-resourced. And in the United States, if you are an older person and you need care, you have essentially two options. One is if you were very forward-looking and wealthy, you could have bought long-term care insurance, which is a private market product, insurance product, that helps people pay for long-term care when they need it. A lot of people think that Medicare pays for long-term care, which is our healthcare program for people who are 65 and older. It does not, actually, at all. So a lot of people think they don't need to buy this insurance product because Medicare will cover it, and it doesn't. And the insurance product is very expensive. Very few people can afford it. And it often doesn't cover what you need when you need it. We hear so many complaints about this product. And then the only other option is to completely deplete your assets and get on Medicaid. And then you might be eligible for nursing home care, and in a few states you might be eligible for home care, but it's very limited. And you have to completely impoverish yourself, which means that there can be no transfer of wealth to your children, right, or any way that you're actually enjoying your older years. And it is a huge driver of inequality in America because you're essentially depleting the wealth and the savings of older people who simply need support and services as they grow more frail. So it's a huge issue, and there's no money in the system, therefore, to pay for the workforce to have sustainable wages and benefits and training and all the things that any workforce needs. So what we need is to reinvest in a revolutionary way in our care economy, and we believe that once we do that, so many pieces of our economy will be so much more sustainable, right? We'll actually be able to have a workforce, a care workforce that can sustain itself, and I want to say more about that in a little bit, how important mm-hmm. that is. All the family caregivers who are stressing out about how they're going to afford care, manage care, take care of their loved one while working full time, all of that productivity that's lost in the stress of that management, right, can be regained. And then the quality of life that we can create for people when they actually have the support they need, whether it's in their home and in their community or in an assisted living facility, right now there just is not, there aren't those choices.
Yeah, I mean, I think the case of, both my parents were killed by lack of care provision. So even when you can afford it, so you can get into debt to pay for care, even in that case, in this country, there was just nothing there. So there are now 7 care deserts in Britain where no matter how rich you are, there's nothing, absolutely nothing. And in other areas where there is state care homes, the quality of them is actually really, really tragic, to the extent that a nurse said to me, you know, she would never recommend that anybody, not even a sick dog, was put into these homes. So even if you're in a country with state care, mm-hmm. where you're mother is entitled to every single provision available because they're completely disabled, there is nobody to care. Mm. And there aren't even any private care workers available because they get treated so badly. It's like in Britain, the industry is so shocking that people don't want to work in care. Mm-hmm. So I think we've got different issues here, because inheritance is a really interesting one that you mentioned, because even if you got rid of all inheritance and spent all the inheritance tax on care, which has been a radical suggestion, you still are unlikely to have the care provision if the care provision is always provided by hedge funds and companies that are built on extracting value from the elderly. Mm-hmm. So for me, there's a really interesting difference between a European system that actually has a state and welfare that is actually crumbling at the core and there is no provision, an American system that relies upon private finance and provision and that still has got quite a lot of issues. And then if we transfer it to the rest of the world, where there's just no provision at all, and actually it's exporting the care workers. So for me, this is such a big issue that we really need big scale thinking about this. We do really need to think. So if you think private insurance is going to save people, I'd say no, because who are the private insurers? The people who want a 15% return on their expenditure.
Right.
So we've got to think, how do we do this?
Well, I think it's actually a huge opportunity in a few ways. One is there's such an obvious need. I think everyone agrees that our existing care infrastructure is insufficient at best, right? And actually, insufficient and unsustainable at best. Yeah. And the opportunity to reimagine it and invest in it is actually a huge, huge opportunity. Yeah. The opportunity of generations to rethink a key part of our society that can unlock so much potential and growth in other ways. And one piece, I'm sure many of you have been in meetings or classes or discussions about the future of work, where there's a lot of conversation about how automation and artificial intelligence is going to displace large segments of our workforce, and a lot of uncertainty and anxiety about what that means for working people and for our societies. And all of those questions are right, and it's true that we don't actually know what will happen. But one thing we do know is that we are going to need care, and that these jobs are jobs that cannot be outsourced, and they're not going to be automated anytime soon. In the United States, they've been trying to build a robot to fold a towel for 11 years and been unsuccessful so far. So we know, at least for the foreseeable future, we are going to need human beings providing care for our loved ones, and I think we want that. I know I want that for the people that I love and who raised me. And we want those human beings to also be able to take care of their families. And so a lot of economists are starting to turn their attention to the fact that it's true we don't know what kind of work will be there in the future, but we do know that a lot of it will be in-person service work like care work, right? And so this huge question and opportunity of how do we then make these jobs really good jobs, right?
That people want to do.
Right. Some economists are even predicting that care jobs, if you take child care and elder care jobs combined, that by the year 2030, they will be the largest occupation in the entire U.S. workforce, care jobs. And right now, they're completely unsustainable. High rates of turnover,
Massive. Tons
of burnout. Mm. And we end up losing some of our very best caregivers to other low-wage service jobs like fast food and retail when we have this huge labor shortage.
Yeah, I know. 90,000 in this country.
So there's an opportunity here to make these good jobs. And I would say that this is something in the United States that we've done before. Manufacturing jobs used to be dangerous poverty wage jobs. And we transformed those jobs into pathways to real economic mobility for millions, for several generations. So
why don't we generally take these jobs a lot more seriously? Why don't we pay them well? Why?
I don't know. What do you think, feminist economist?
Well, I think to quite a few people sitting in this room, gender's a pretty key part of
all
this.
Okay, there we go.
And, you know, all the work you've done and we've done on the care sandwich.
Yes.
You know, women are looking after their children and they're looking after the elderly. And that's becoming, it used to just be childcare that you did until the age of 50, but now you've got elderly care as well.
Yeah.
And it's taken for granted, yeah.
We call it the panini effect in the
United
States.
Because you have
you're squeezed between the child care pressure yeah. and the elder care pressure.
Yeah. So I think that is definitely key to it. But if the future of work is going to be about care provision, mm-hmm. if we all need it, and especially if our children and our elderly, we're going to need it, why do we disregard it? I mean, I just cannot get my head around the fact that people want to pay people $5 an hour mm-hmm. to look after their dearest people in their life that have given them care. That to me, it's extraordinary. And, you know, I'm sure gender's part of it. And that's how you've been working, haven't you? You've been kind of working around that issue.
Absolutely. I think gender is fundamental. I think most issues that are fundamental to women's lives have been kind of sidelined and treated as special interest or soft issues as opposed to national priorities, and that has to change. And I think that we have culturally seen care as a personal burden to be managed and figured out on our own, as opposed to an urgent social issue in need of a collective solution. And that is a shift, a culture shift that we actually have to make and catalyze. And we have a really rare opportunity right now to make that shift as millennials are starting to have babies, as boomers are caring for their parents. I mean, two huge culture-driving generations are right in the thick of the care crisis. Mm-hmm. And I always say, if any generation can change culture, it's the people who brought us rock and roll and social justice, the boomers. So if they can change our attitudes around care together with a millennial generation, which is also a huge culture-driving generation, massive possibilities there, but we have to make it happen. And it is an organizing challenge, which is why we've built this movement.
And I think I want to ask one more question and then we'll open it out. And I want people to think, you know, why is this? Why do we disregard carers or devalue or give no value to carers who really do look after our most, the people we most care about? Why is this massive contradiction? Why do we allow that to happen? And where does responsibility lie for those we care about? So I want you to put those on hold and think about those while I carry on asking AJ just one more, because I do want to open it out. Because we're talking about the future of work, and it is amazing how many people you've managed to organise. And you have relied on the digital platform somewhat. Mm-hmm. So that's been really significant, because you've used digital platforms to kind of bring people together and access what you call shadow labour. Mm-hmm. Could you say a little more about that?
Sure. Well, the domestic workforce in the United States is not, there's no registry or list anywhere. It's 2.5 million, probably many more, women who are working in individual, isolated households all over the country. You could walk into any neighborhood and not know which homes are also workplaces. It's completely invisible. And so the organizing has always been incredibly challenging, because where do you find people? How do you find people? Even enforcing the rights that we've created, that we've passed, the bills of rights, how do you enforce house by house, right? It's especially when those homes are unlisted. And so we have really, in that context, really looked for ways that workers can be aggregated, and really technology has created a whole new set of opportunities for us to do that, to engage groups of workers and to reach workers at a different scale. And we combine that with the traditional organizing that I started out doing. Literally in 1998, I would go to the parks and the playgrounds in New York City and talk to nannies who were sitting with the children that they take care of in the parks and playing with them, and I would ask them about their stories and their working conditions and invite them to meetings and trainings. And we still do that, and we combine it with the ability to reach people through networks, through social media, and online. And now we have these technology platforms that are actually dispatching work and helping families and workers find one another. And those are aggregating workers at unprecedented numbers, right? Some of them are quite large, like care.com is massive. It's a marketplace for care where families and caregivers get matched. And I think that one of the things that we realized is that all of those platforms none of them were really designed with the worker in mind, right? They're really designed for the consumer. And so for us, there is an opportunity for aggregation and in trying to see how we can reach workers through those platforms where there already are aggregated in search of work. And we've also seen the need to build our own technology as a movement. And one of the things that we've done is create an innovation lab called NDWA Labs, where we've actually recruited engineers and entrepreneurs and designers to come and work for our movement to help us develop technology to improve the quality of jobs, raise wages, and also to help us organize with technology. And one of the things that we've just launched is a benefits platform, a portable benefits platform called ALIA. It's at myalia, ALIA.org, and it allows for domestic workers with multiple clients to get access to benefits for the very first time. Benefits like paid time off and accident insurance and life insurance. And the way that it works is if you have somebody come clean your home, you put in, for every cleaning, a $5 contribution into her benefits account, and she gets to collect those contributions from all the people whose home she cleans for. That money gets aggregated into her account, and then she gets to decide what benefit she wants to apply the money in her account towards. So it's a pretty big breakthrough in terms of the technology that will allow a really disaggregated workforce to get access to a safety net that many of us take for granted. But that's the kind of way that we're trying to leverage technology as a social movement to raise wages, improve conditions, and to help support this workforce and to support the creation of good jobs.
It's been a way that's your digital infrastructure.
It is. We're trying to build
your grid.
A worker-centered digital infrastructure.
Yeah. That kind of almost sits on top of but challenges those that are just selling care workers in competition with each other.
Exactly.
And so your last, well, I'll end talking to you and open it out. Your last kind
of... Are you guys
of,
okay? Is this boring? Okay, good. Okay.
Well, we'll open it out and then there'll be more exciting.
All right, good.
Your universal, you're just about to launch universal family care. Tell us more about that.
Okay, so this is our big solution to the care infrastructure problem in the United States. We are about to propose a whole new vision for the care economy in the United States that we call universal family care. The idea that there should be one public insurance fund that everyone contributes to, that everyone can benefit from, that helps you pay for childcare, elder care, and paid family leave. Everything you need to take care of your families while you're working. Make sense? Simple. And what it will do is it will create enough of a risk pool and enough of a financing mechanism that we will finally, once and for all, be able to make every last job in the care economy also a living wage job with benefits. That's the vision. And on Monday in Washington, D.C., we will be releasing a study panel. A group of academics studied the viability of universal family care in states first, and we will be releasing the results of that academic study on Monday in Washington.
yeah, that's just a few days from now.
Yeah.
I got to get home.
That's why you stay for like 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very exciting because it's in the midst of presidential primaries in the United States, where it is very much an ideas-driven primary. I don't know how many of you have been following, but we have not one, not two, not three, not four, but 24 Democratic candidates for president. And what's beautiful about it is that it has been very much about, what are your ideas? What are your solutions? How are you going to solve the most pressing challenges of our time? And every candidate is going to be looking to distinguish themselves, and we have a beautiful idea for revolutionizing the care economy that they can take up should they choose. So this is our moment to really try to elevate a care economy solution into the national public policy debate at a really critical time in our nation's, at a really critical juncture in our nation's history. So we're excited, we're hopeful, and yeah.
Great. Right. So let's open it out for questions. Whoa. Oh, my goodness. That's a lot of questions. I saw yours first, if we can. So if you keep your hands up for a minute, and then we'll know where to send the microphone. So there's definitely some over there. Oh, over there. And then here. Yes. So if you'd like to start, and I can see one, two behind you as well. So, yeah, would you like to start?
Thank you very much, and welcome to London. Just to introduce myself very briefly, to give some context for the question I want to ask you. My name is Mandu Reed. I'm the leader of the UK Women's Equality Party. We're the first and only feminist political party in British history. And just a little kind of quiz question for you. Not quiz question, pub quiz. I'm actually the first person of colour to lead a political party in Britain's history. So there's some extra context there. But my question for you really is about this idea. I mean, what we try and do is we try and make the mainstream political players up their levels of ambition when it comes to gender equality.
Yeah.
And the question I have for you, because I'm really in awe of the movement you've managed to create, 50 to begin with, 200,000 now across the USA. Fantastic. But from an organizing point of view and from an exerting pressure point of view, what does it take to make this issue politically expedient? What kind of strategy and tactics would you recommend, or would you do you think could be deployed? Because I feel like, you know, a care worker strike is not so ethical, you know, a national care worker strike. But I'm really curious as to what your reflections and insights are on how you make this issue politically expedient.
Uh-huh. What we'll do, we'll take three, because we've got a lot here, and then if that's okay, you can add them together. Is that okay? So behind and behind, I think it was. Yeah, right behind as well.
Thank you. I don't like to tell my background, but the first question says that the background. I say that I'm a visiting professor to LSE. I'm from China. I work for the Chinese Communist Party, but I'm very interested in the topic. I must say that thank you for your brilliant presentation. Thank you for what you did. A great job. There's a very popular saying in London. I'd like to describe you, a great, great woman.
We'll all agree with that.
Yes, like that. My question is like that. I'm an economist, and you use the care economy, and you use your health care, family care, universal health care. Yes, what's the... Yes, to what extent, when you say that the health care economy is a market-oriented one, or to what extent is a kind of voluntary one, what kind of role, in your opinion, the government can play to, for example, to promote the care economy? Yes, you said that it's kind of American phenomenon. When can you put your idea to a worldwide one? Thank you.
Great. And there was one just... Oh, there's two in that row. So if we take those, and then we'll move over there. Okay. So two. Yep.
Hi, I'm Madhu, and really incredibly inspired by what you just shared. I work as... Also, to provide some context, I work as a sustainability strategist at an environmental sustainability nonprofit organization, And I'm working in Indonesia on what decent rural living looks like for palm workers. And we bring together five of the biggest palm manufacturers on looking at that. And what strikes me is really interesting intersections between what you shared in the context of the US and in Indonesia in terms of women being disproportionately affected. And it's quite interesting because for the palm sector, it is about how fruit that falls into the ground, all the harvesting is a man's job because it's quite a patriarchal industry, whereas women do things like pesticide spraying, which is health, it affects the health disproportionately, cancer and infertility issues and all sorts of stuff. And one of the things that we genuinely struggle with is the fact that it's a very untraceable supply chain and we can't access the workers. And because of how patriarchal it is, most women don't even regard sexual harassment as a genuine grievance. It's seen as background noise. How do you actually work with that? How do you actually work with these women to help them see something as a grievance and to want to organize around it? Thank you so much.
So there's one more question. Is that okay to take four?
Yeah. Hi, I have two questions. I'll try to make it quick. Hi, my name is Leanne Sajor. I'm an incoming Atlantic Fellow. I'm originally from the Philippines, but I'm based in New York City right now, and I've actually organized with the Mayan before for the New York Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. So
awesome.
I'm really excited to meet you, and I love this talk. So two questions, right? When I was working with the Mayan, which is a local Filipino domestic workers' rights organization, the organizing work there and the accountability of that organizing work really was about the workers themselves, right? Mm-hmm. They are setting the agenda. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of this campaign that you spoke about, I wonder where do you place, I mean, this is connected to your question about organizing, where do you place the accountability in the organizing work when you are working with families, care recipients, and the domestic workers, right? Mm-hmm. Where does accountability sit in those conversations and the decision-making and in terms of agenda setting? Mm-hmm. My second question is because I've worked with domestic workers alliances in Indonesia before, and as Professor Bev mentioned, this is a global problem, right? This is a global care chain that we're talking about. Recipient countries and sending countries is, we have complex systems that create this. Because of the Asian financial crisis that happened in 1997, a lot of women left Indonesia to work in Hong Kong and became domestic workers because of that. So my question to you is, in the conversation, especially in international spaces, how do you introduce or integrate a conversation around structural problems, including international financial institutions, into these conversations, which definitely, kind of create the environment for women to have to leave their countries, especially women who are, marginalized and coming from poor working class backgrounds. Thank you.
Wow, there's some really difficult questions there. How to organize sustainability, recognizing things like sexual harassment, structural problems and accountability. Go on.
That's hard. Hard questions.
Great. Okay. So on the political, first of all, thank you for your leadership. We're part of the launch of a new home for women's activism, which is called Supermajority in the United States, which is attempting to call the question on gender equality in a new way. There's a really big rise in the activism of women in the United States post 2016, and we've been trying to harness that energy and channel it towards electoral engagement. And the launch of Supermajority, which happened just a month and a half, a little over a month ago, is a new effort to train 2 million women organizers to advance a gender equality agenda. It's really exciting. It's exciting. So I'll say more about that in a second. But in terms of how I think you make care a politically expedient issue, you have to actually go out and organize voters. So one of the things that we did was
we ran a bunch of experiments in 2016. Our theory is that we live in a really divided time in the United States, and the people in power are really, the division is their core strategy, right, to sustain their power. And so one of the things that we have to do is actually create agendas and a narrative about the country that really brings us together, that unifies and unites our interests and our futures in a fundamental way. And care is one of those issues that really does speak to voters across race, class, and generation, and geography. We ran a bunch of experiments in rural counties, in suburban counties, in urban counties with different constituencies of voters. And we found that across the board, even across the ideological spectrum, that investing in access to home care, for example, polled incredibly high. And so in 2016, in the state of Michigan, there was a candidate who ran for office with universal family care as his leading issue. And our organizers on the ground were door knocking, talking to families in that community about their care stories for months before the candidate showed up and decided, I'm going to make universal family care my leading issue. He starts getting on the doors and talking about universal family care, and he ends up winning. 25-year-old man was the only seat that flipped from Republican to Democrat in the 2016 election cycle in that state. And he won by 300 or so votes in a district that Trump won by 6,000 votes. So it really shows that this is an issue that really does bridge and build alliances and power. And so that's what we've been trying to prove again and again every year, so that candidates who are interested in winning know that this is a winning issue. That's the thing, is that women are always underestimated, and the things we care about are always undervalued, but there is so much power in them. And when organized and framed, we can change everything, I think. And so that's the argument we're going to make with universal family care this year. And then Supermajority just launched, and we're spending the summer talking to women about their priority issues, and then we're going to spend the fall uplifting those priorities as a new women's agenda, right? And then we're going to make all the candidates who want to be president of the United States talk about how they're going to make those priorities national priorities. And then we're going to train 2 million women organizers and organize the largest volunteer canvas in the history of the United States. So there were 10 other questions here, including what is the
role of government.
One of the
really hard ones was big structural problems as well. How do you introduce that? How do you address the big structural problems?
Well, it kind of goes to that question, which is that the way you address big structural problems is through building power. You have to build power. It comes down to power. And it's not just political power, actually. It's also what I call narrative power, the ability to tell the story of why things are the way that they are in the world on your terms, right? The ability essentially to define reality. It's also economic power, the ability to direct capital and shape markets, right? There's many vectors of power, and we have to be, as movements, working on all of those and being able to understand how power is operating so we can democratize it, right?
Great, thank you. So there was three over there. There was two at the back and one at the front. Had the hands up immediately. And then we'll probably be able to go back over here. Oh, is there any at the top? Did you get those over there? Yeah, we had two there and then one down there.
Hi, I'm Marlene. I'm a health systems consultant And I wanted to ask you a question relating what you mentioned about technology and the many ideas from current Democratic candidates. Because one of your candidates is Andrew Yang, who is currently running for president, and he launched an idea relating to time banking, where people would actually, carers would have the opportunity to bank their time and get paid for it in return by governments. And I wanted to ask you what you think about this idea by Andrew Yang and whether you think governments would be interested in investing in something like this, which requires a new way of looking at economies, but something that could potentially be very cost-effective, maybe in terms of investing for governments. Thank you.
Okay, great. And behind you.
Hello, my name is Maria Cristina. I'm based here at the sociology department. I'm a PhD student. My PhD is on homelessness and care work in Athens. And it doesn't have to do with domestic care, but it has to do with the work care workers put in spaces of care in the city. And I've also struggled with a question about why we don't care about the care workers. And I need to say my PhD started as a homelessness project, but then I couldn't study homelessness without the carers. And the situations I've seen are that, like, care workers deal with, as you said, like, life-threatening and challenging situations, urgent situations. And as you said, care is life-sustaining. And I'm wondering if both the caregiving and the care-receiving ends are under such vulnerable and challenging situations. Mm-hmm. To what extent do the employers, the organizations, the NGOs, the states just take advantage of this and of this very human moment that, okay, what is this care worker actually going to do? Leave this homeless person like this. Leave this old lady who has a very, who just needs care at this specific moment. And then if both ends are so vulnerable, and they are in a sandwich situation as well, then to what extent does this play a role, the life-sustaining nature of care?
Yeah. Great. And could we just come down to the front? There was one there.
Hi. Thanks for that really amazing talk. I really enjoyed it. Thinking about, like, why care work is so not valued, I guess I wonder if part of the reason is because most care work isn't paid. And most of the care work that we do for our families anyway. So, like, getting it to be valued financially when the vast majority of the way in which we look after children, disabled people, older people is just what women do. Mm-hmm. I wonder then if that is the case, whether it's possible to be organising paid and unpaid domestic work, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the 1970s wages for housework campaign comes to mind, and I know that in the left there's been a bit of a resurgence of some of those ideas that came out at that time with the recent Verso recently published a book, Full Surrogacy Now, which deals with some of these ideas and actually identifies the way that pregnancy and looking after children works in capitalism. You know, this is actually work that is unpaid, and the central argument of the book is that eventually we should be looking towards abolishing the family and having much more communal approach to social reproduction. But in the meantime, we should be fighting for wages for these things. I guess I wonder whether or not, like, there seems to be a fairly arbitrary distinction between who does and doesn't get paid for exactly the same work, and whether we should be organising for all the rights of all of the people that are doing this work.
Great. Would you like to take... Mm-hmm. Would you like to take those questions?
Yeah. So on the time banking thing, care time banking, where are you? There you are. That actually, there is a model for that in Japan that's been quite successful. It wasn't actually Andrew's idea.
Can you say a bit more about it? Because I don't know about it.
There's a time banking model in Japan where basically...
They created a time bank where if you go and you take care of your neighbor for a few hours, buy them groceries, check in on them, make sure they're okay, help them clean their home, you can bank those hours and try to cash it in for your mother who lives on the other side of the island for somebody else to support her. And there's it's basically like a time exchange, a care exchange that is coordinated through technology. And I think it's a really inspiring model. It's definitely worth looking into. We would need, I think, some pilots in the United States first to just work it out. But I think it also fits in. Look, what I've been arguing for is thinking about the care economy as infrastructure. And when you think about the definition of infrastructure is, it's kind of that which enables everything else in the economy, commerce, everything else in the economy to happen, transportation systems, right, energy. And we know culturally that we have to invest in and maintain infrastructure, right? Some societies do it better than others, but there's like a cultural norm that we have to do that. Care is like that. Care is what we need. It's part of the energy, and it's a system that we need in place to support everything else in the economy to function, and we need to be investing in it and maintaining it in that way. Only the key difference is that humans are a really big part of that infrastructure, the workforce. So we also need to be investing in those humans, but not in the way we invest in roads, like, right, as humans. So it's different. It's a different kind of infrastructure, but I think we do in the 21st century need to be thinking of it that way, and I think time banks can be a part of it. I think we have to think about unpaid, right, family caregivers and professional caregivers as both part of that human infrastructure. And I think that our old silos of paid versus unpaid are not serving us, right? And so I don't know if that's we pay everyone or what that looks like, but I do know that it is going to be the care situation in this world, definitely in the United States, is an all hands on deck situation. We're going to need a really strong workforce. We're going to need family members and volunteers, neighbors, friends, family. We're going to need immigrants, citizens, everyone we're going to need. And that's actually a good thing. We're all going to have care squads, right? Care teams that work together as ensembles to make sure that the people that we love can age and live well as they do. And so I guess it's about how do we rethink not from a scarcity, right? When you start to think paid, unpaid, it really is about how you're counting limited dollars. But what if we took a step back from that kind of scarcity model and thought about the abundance of the human capacity to care?
Yeah, most definitely, because it is. What's really interesting is that people do want to care.
They do.
Yeah, and
it's a beautiful thing.
Exactly, and it's. I mean, I found it really shocking when some of the care workers who were looking after my mum were kind of caring in spite of the conditions in which they were
being treated. Like trash. Yeah,
yes, exactly. Just, you know, 15 minutes to come in and do everything. I mean, it's just extraordinary. So there is a desire to care. I think we are caring. I think there's been successive governments that have talked us out of trying to care. You know, that focus on individualism, that focus on profit, that focus on self-development and all that kind of stuff. And it's like it stopped us thinking about others. And I think what's very important in your book is the amount of care that people do want to do and, you know, benefit from. So we've got to think about these different models. We'll have time for one more question. Is there one?
I want to speak to the role of government really quickly.
Okay.
Just because I know that you're here and you asked it and you want an answer. And so the way I think about this is I'm actually a person who believes that if a market can solve the problem, it should. If the market can solve a problem, it should. I actually think that the market cannot solve this. That this is something in need of a public and collective solution. even, for example, the private insurance companies that sell private long-term care insurance, even they will pull me aside in meetings when I'm ever in the same room with them, and they'll be like, we know this product sucks. We're trying to get out of it. It's bad. It doesn't work. I mean, literally, it's not viable. We actually need a public solution because the scope of the problem is what it is. It's about all of us. It's about societies and our ability to support our families while we're working and participating in the economy. It's bigger than a product that the market can sell us. I don't know if that answers your question, but
we had one pressing question down. Well, two now. We've got one there. We can take two, yes? So Kripa there and then behind you.
First of all, thank you so much. We're waiting for this since very long, so thank you so much for your experience sharing. So I wanted to ask about the power dynamics that is there inside National Domestic Workers Alliance. You're dealing with 200,000 people, you know, so how you dealing with that? It's super impressive, you know, but at the same time, looking at domestic workers coming from different countries, you know, where maybe Filipino domestic workers might be more prioritized and looked upon than in comparison to someone from South Asia, you know. So how do you deal with that in terms of power dynamics? The other part is, you know, the whole concept around care crisis. So if men take on more caring responsibilities, then will this care crisis be resolved or not? What do you have to say about that?
And then one behind, and then that will be it in terms of questions.
Thank you. I wonder, in the United States, whether you think that a demonstration project within a single state, for example, Massachusetts, might be a viable way forward. Mm-hmm. And if so, would you be willing to collaborate with a proposal that we have in front of the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee in the Massachusetts legislature?
Okay, sorry, there was one more up there. I had the microphone. That's going to be a very specific one, but would you like to ask your question quickly?
Yeah, definitely. This is going to be very quick. I just want to address the primal question that a distinguished professor has asked the audience from the very beginning. Why are we not taking this care job seriously? Mm. You can put a lot of answers to that. I am speaking as a nurse working in this industry for a long, long time. I was born in the Philippines, lived there for the past 27 years, went to China, went to Taiwan, went to the USA, and now currently here, and did a personal study on, you know, domestic care and care in and of itself from a scientific, theoretical point of view up to the grassroots level. I'm just going to answer that question that you have. And the answer to that question might probably be that the public is, I'm afraid that the public is not really aware that it is in the care receiver's interest that the caregiver should be protected. And unless we spread that message in the public, whether you put a policy remedy, a political remedy, it will never go forward in a more impactful way. Now, to the question for Agent Poo. So there's this saying that if you want to change the world, go back to your family, right? So what I did was, in that many years of studying care, I then realized, just recently, I received a phone call in the middle of the night from my parents that, look, we need a caregiver because your grandmother is ill, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, fine. Now, then goes to, how are we going to solve this? And I and my friends in New Zealand, we're formulating a framework, and this is what I want to see. If you think this framework works, this framework, we call this framework as goal bargaining framework, wherein, for example, in my family, we recently hired a 19-year-old caregiver, and I told her, I spoke to her directly and I said, what do you really want to have in this work that you want to get into my family? She said, I want to get back to your studies. And I said, fine, you go to study, and then you work in ways that, you know, let's work things out. And I said, what other things that you want? I want my younger brother also to go to school, okay? We'll send your brother, younger brother to go to school. So the framework is simple. If we have our caregiver, ask clearly what he or she wants in this work, because you have to understand that to make a really good quality care, you need to understand that long-term continuity is essential. Human touch is only as good as you trust that person to touch you. So that, do you think that that framework works from the grassroots level?
Okay, we only have time for like one very quick answer to those three questions, which are going to be impossible to put together because Massachusetts is very specific.
Do you want to have a go?
Well, I would say that it, just on the culture of our movement, that we really do find the incredible diversity of our workforce to be a source of tremendous power. And so we really try to have it be fundamental to how we organize. And we pay a lot of attention to things like making sure that there's simultaneous interpretation in every single call, every single meeting in at least 5 different languages, depending on who's on the phone. And that we build a culture where people are very patient with that, with interpretation in a multilingual environment. And that takes time. It takes energy. It takes good facilitation. It takes an investment. And we also really try to look and see where we can help balance where there are inequities. So, for example, we knew through the census data that there were a lot of African-American domestic workers in the South, in particular, still doing this work. But most of our affiliates at the time were immigrant worker organizations at the grassroots level. So we decided as a national office to launch a special campaign called We Dream in Black to support the organizing and leadership of African-American women in our industry. And now we have 3 vibrant chapters in the South of African-American domestic workers. So we really try to look for ways to create equity and a sense of responsibility and sisterhood, because that is our strength, right? This sisterhood across difference, the culture is built around the notion that that is actually what makes us really powerful. And what puts us in a position to put forward big, bold solutions, because we know that they are coming from a whole diversity and range of experiences within our industry. I don't know if that is exactly your question, but and then there are mechanisms for workers within each different category, whether they're doing childcare, or they're doing cleaning, or they're doing elder care, to actually shape what we put forward as the standards, what should be the fair standards for that segment of the industry. There are worker councils that are democratically elected. Our board is democratically elected, so my bosses are domestic workers. And that is a way that we make sure that we are reflective and accountable to our membership base. It takes a lot of organizers, and we're increasingly getting better at deploying digital organizers and digital tools to get feedback and engage workers. And you just have to with 200,000 people. I mean, with an industry as disaggregated as we are and as large as we are and as quickly growing as we are, we're going to need to be able to use technology in more and more sophisticated ways. So we're continuing to do that as well.
Now, I don't think we have time for the other questions. I'm very sorry, Massachusetts and gold standard. Gold standard should be something we always aim towards. And
yes.
If you actually read Adrian Poo's book, you'll see that they have a set of various different standards that apply right across the board in terms of the treatment of care workers. So I think you'll see, you'll get your answer from that. I'd just like to say thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you all for turning up tonight. It's great to see such a large audience, and hopefully it does mean that you will consider this to be a major issue. And it's one that you'll be hearing more from the International Inequalities Institute, where we're going to keep it on the agenda. So thank you very much.